So hello everyone, I'm Felicity Brown from the Asia Pacific Career Development Association's podcast Series 4, and I'd like to welcome my co-host Ruchira Tripathi. Hi Ruchira, how are you today?
Hi Felicity, and hello to the guest as well. Felicity is going to introduce more, but I'm so excited about this session today.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So let me introduce today's guests. On reaching adulthood, Michael Wilson, today's guest, was planning a career as a classical musician, but fate and circumstances had other ideas. In a career spanning over three decades, Michael has been a community arts advocate, a ministerial advisor, he's run for parliament, negotiated international environmental treaties, hired CEOs to run major companies, thwarted transnational crime and terrorism, managed overseas aid programming in Asia worth over $350 million a year, and sung at a stadium rock concert in front of 50,000 people. Wow, I don't know how you fit that all in. Now he's the CEO of a company called eWater, which exists to improve the management of water resources across Australia and overseas by giving decision makers accurate, timely, and evidence-based information and expertise to help them make wise choices. Michael, I'm exhausted just reading that, but tell me, how did it all happen? Was there ever a plan?
Hi, Felicity, and hi, Ruchira. Really good to see you today, and thanks for the invitation. So, was there ever a plan? The truth is there were probably a couple of plans early on in my career. First of all, my plan was to train as an opera singer. So I suppose my dream in my late teens and early 20s was to tread the opera stages of the world as a classical baritone. And then later on, once I'd got over that one, I was really considering a career in politics. And that sort of explains some of my career decisions on that pathway. But again, once I decided that wasn't for me, I was much more open to seeing what opportunities presented and started to focus a little bit more on the sorts of things that I needed to stay interested and engaged and to feel like I was making a contribution. So there wasn't a definite plan in terms of career steps and jobs I wanted to tick off the list, but it became important for me to follow a value system, I guess, and that certainly shaped my choices into my 30s and 40s.
Tell us a bit more about your values.
So it became pretty clear to me, particularly as I turned away from things that I thought I wanted to spend my life and career doing and turned towards other things which I found almost surprisingly fulfilling, that I needed in my work life to feel like I was contributing to the betterment of humankind, the betterment of the planet. And it was important to me to feel like I could point to legacies that I left behind as I moved on changes, positive changes that I could give myself some credit for.
So, can I get back to the opera singing? You turned away from it. Can I ask why?
It was probably a pragmatic decision more than anything else. So, first of all, my voice type, I was sort of a lyric baritone, so light baritone in the opera and song cycle repertoire. And it is the most common male voice type. So I didn't have the range to be a tenor. Tenors get all of the lead roles in most of the opera repertoire. And baritones are a bit more dime a dozen. So if you're going to make it as a baritone, you really have to have three things going for you. You have to have an extraordinary instrument, you have to have extraordinary luck, and you have to have extraordinary single-mindedness and focus. And I probably decided around the age of 22 or 23 that I probably didn't have enough of any of those three. I had other interests outside music. I was studying with a group of peers who, it was clear to me, were very much more focused and confident that this was their career, that this was their life calling, than I felt I had. And, you know, I didn't have particular luck. And I did feel for every technical breakthrough in one's development as a musician, I had to work very, very hard for it. And it was obvious to me that for a lot of my peers, things came a bit more easily. So I kind of decided that I would need to feel a more natural fit as a professional musician than I felt as a full-time student. So that was the point I stepped back, and I had a lot of good advice from my singing teachers and coaches at the time. That doesn't mean stepping back from a full-time musical career doesn't mean not doing music. It means actually you've got more choice. It's always going to be something important in your life if you keep it going as an amateur. And so that's what I've done. I've always sung in choirs since leaving the music degree. I still do. I still enjoy that. So I felt the investment was very worthwhile early in my life because it gave me a strong basis for what I'm still able to do in my spare time.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your growing up years, because you seem to have such a wide, varied, you know, wide range of interests. And also you talked about your value system where, you know, you feel that you want to contribute to the betterment of mankind and environment. So how did your growing up years kind of shape that is what I'm curious to know. What were those years like?
Sure. So I was born in Canberra and I still live in Canberra, but I've spent periods of my life away, including when I was very young. We spent as a family a couple of years living in Singapore. My father was a university academic political scientist and went to Singapore to help set up Nanyang Technical University when I was quite young. And Singapore in the early 1970s was a very different place to what we know of it now, still very much in a development phase. So I suppose I was exposed to different cultures and language and food and everything that comes with living overseas from an early age. But I also had two parents, both professionals. My mother was a research librarian and worked in the Federal Parliamentary Library for most of her career after leaving work at the library at the Australian National University, which is where my parents met. And both of them had a very strong social conscience. So I was brought up in an atmosphere where debate over human issues, political issues, historical issues, issues of morals and values was very much encouraged. That was dinner time conversation. My parents encouraged me into that, didn't seek to screen me from, I suppose, adult conversation that might have been happening between them and their friends in the context of our household. And I was an only child as well. So if you're an only child, you learn to engage, I guess, in adult conversations because there aren't the distractions of siblings to play with all the time. So I embraced that and continue to have a great deal of respect for the values that my parents based their careers and behaviours on, and which guided the way they interacted with other people and what they spent their spare time on. So in retirement, both my parents spent time on refugee action issues, on Indigenous reconciliation, on building up the confidence of the next generation of academics. So that was very much the context that I lived with.
So you obviously, it sounds like you had a lot of adult presence in your life and heard a lot of adult conversations, but who were your heroes as a child, whether they were other adults or any other figures?
So my heroes as a child tended to be political figures in history, and that changed over time based on the more I read about people and current, I suppose, current prominent figures. So certainly growing up in the early 70s in Australia, well, Gough Whitlam was certainly a hero, although I probably didn't know why. But my father worked for Gough for a while, and they were quite close friends, but also political allies. And we saw a bit of Gough around the family home. He, particularly when he was opposition leader before he became prime minister, he would come over to our place, and he and Dad would talk politics in Southeast Asia, which was my father's academic area of interest and research. I also became quite interested in the history and politics of the United States in the 20th century. So people like Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy, both figures that I read a lot about and studied quite closely. Less interested in the European arena for some reason. And then later in life, figures in Australian public life who had the courage and the guts to stand up for things that were perhaps unpopular and swim against the tide, including some of the, I suppose, last generation of Indigenous Australian leaders who I think challenged a nation that still saw itself as reasonably young to come to terms with its very ancient components. So I certainly remember following the advocacy of Charles Perkins pretty closely later on, including through connections with my grandfather, people like Lewitcher O'Donoghue. And later, when I was working in the political sphere as a ministerial advisor, it was at the time just following the Mabo decision of the High Court and the development of the Keating Labor government of the Native Title Act, I was, while not directly connected with that, I was in amongst those negotiations and witnessing those Aboriginal leaders regularly coming into Parliament House for discussions with politicians and decision makers. And in fact, I was in the advisor's box in the Senate chamber the night that the Native Title Act passed, which I think was shortly after midnight, if my memory serves me correctly. And, you know, it was an incredible event and something I'll never forget. So I sort of looked up to people who were pursuing values-based advocacy and often as mavericks, or would have been seen as mavericks against sort of mainstream Australian political opinion of the time. Not necessarily radical, but those with the confidence to really hold Australia and the public policy discussion to account for its blind spots. Seeing these public figures, but also understanding them in their private lives and how they drew a balance between those various roles was an important education for me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's certainly running in some esteemed circles there. Can I take you back to high school, your schooling years, and sort of moving on to university? Tell us about, you know, what you thought your career was going to be like, if you had some ideas back then, what you were following, where your interests were, including, of course, you have a lot of that influence from your family and the circles that they were in. But tell us a bit about your journey around your schooling years to university.
Well, I do remember very early on thinking it'd be quite fun to be a fireman. Moving into high school, I tended to switch my ideas quite a bit and quite regularly. And that was in response to exposure I had to individuals and roles that I found interesting or which were new to me. So I did think for a while about being a high school teacher. I had some, as I think most people do, I had some completely remarkable teachers in high school who influenced me hugely. Certainly a couple of music teachers, one English teacher in particular who I had throughout years 11 and 12, who was quite an extraordinary individual and very, very sort of left field in a way. A couple of history teachers who were very important to me, and I, observing the way that they encouraged and caused enthusiasm for their subject in their students, I thought was pretty fascinating, because I think in any area of endeavor, when you need to bring people along with you, you need to think specifically and deeply about what in your behaviors can you do to motivate people to follow you. And while I didn't probably see these experiences as training me for leadership, I think observing how people had a clear passion for their subject, but could also feel techniques to get even sort of cynical and sometimes uninterested high school boys, because I went to an all boys, to really, really embrace the subjects, that was very important grounding for me in a range of ways for later steps I took in my career and later interests I took up. So, you know, later in my career, I suppose in my 20s and early 30s, I started to think a lot more about what leadership meant and what empowering leadership meant. And I'd really started to think about that in high school as I observed these very effective, quite charismatic, quite skilled and quite passionate people do their work in teaching a bunch of occasionally rabble-like boys in a classroom.
Yeah. And so the first career plan was the opera singer. Is that right? Yeah.
I think so, yeah. And I put that off for a while. So I was singing fairly seriously. Probably, yeah, I started lessons, regular lessons after my voice changed. I think I was about 15 or 16. And several people, including many of my music teachers, urged me to have something behind me first before really taking music seriously as a full-time study and full-time career option. And at times I misinterpreted that, I think, as people saying, oh, well, we're not quite sure whether you're good enough to make it, so you better have something else to fall back on. And partly because I'm still in touch with a lot of these people, I realized that it was more practical advice. So, and I did have other interests and I suppose other skills. So I decided to do an arts degree first, and I did an honors degree in political science at the ANU. But always in the background, it was my intention after that degree was under my belt to give music a really solid go. And I was taking, towards the end of my undergraduate degree, I was taking single studies course at the School of Music. So I was already in the cohort of the voice teachers at the Canberra School of Music. And, you know, moved on after graduating from my honours degree in political science to begin a Bachelor of Music degree. I suppose the surprise then was how quickly I developed doubts about whether I was suited to that. Really, I had already been studying for 4 years, so perhaps there was a bit of fatigue, but I really felt within a couple of months of full-time classes in that institution that perhaps I wasn't the right fit. And then what caused me to leave was in fact an extraordinary set of circumstances. I won't say chance, but one of those sliding doors moments. So, you know, I was working reasonably hard in my studies in first year of a Bachelor of Music degree. And then in the space of 1 week, I was offered a full master's scholarship to study international relations at the University of Hawaii and the East-West Center based in Honolulu. Very, very prestigious political science department. And I think a day later, the new arts minister in the Keating government, so we're talking, this is 1990, early 1990, Bob McMullen rang and said, look, I need a performing arts advisor in the office. I can't afford to pay you very much, but would you be interested? And so I had this incredible dilemma, this choice to make suddenly. I was pretty clear that staying in the music degree wasn't going to be the choice I made. It was one of these other opportunities, neither of which I'd entirely expected. So I needed to wrestle with that for a couple of days, but people wanted answers. And I took the role in the arts minister's office. And that was a fabulous opportunity and led to a wonderful 3 years working not only for Bob, but then later for Senator John Faulkner when he became Environment Minister in the Keating government. I worked for him for the last part of the Keating government's last term, and then ended up in the public service.
So how did you make that decision? You know, you had the scholarship, the master's scholarship, you had the job in Bob McMullen's office.
It was really tough.
How did you weigh it up? It was really a tough, yeah.
It was really tough because the scholarship at the University of Hawaii was a full scholarship, so fees and stipend, and it came with a teaching post as well, a teacher's assistantship, I think it was called, which also carried a salary with it. And you know, in US dollars, that was pretty serious, particularly, you know, having been a student for 5 years. But my calculus, this was where I actually engaged in a very serious conversation with my father. And my father was someone who religiously resisted offering career advice, religiously resisted expressing his views about what I should do with my life. He said, it's important you make your own decisions and you're not influenced by, you know, by the opinions of others, most of all your parents. But I said to him, Dad, just this once, I
need really, your help.
I really need to know what you think. And he said to me, look, I hadn't realized he'd faced a very similar choice at a very similar time in his life. He's at the end of his master's studies at the University of Melbourne. He was working, I think, casually in Arthur Calwell's office. And Arthur Calwell was at that stage the leader of the Labor Party in opposition. And he was offered a Fulbright scholarship to Columbia University to do what was then a very prestigious degree called a master's in international affairs. And he, you know, he wanted to specialize in studies and research on China. There weren't that many Australians seeking academic specialization in China. You know, communist China was seen as a bit of a black box. And he said to me, because he took the decision to go to Columbia and work there, he said, the difference between you and I is that I don't think I ever saw myself as a political candidate. I think you do. And certainly working as an advisor early in your career and being exposed to the processes of executive government, but also politics, obviously on the Labor Party side of the aisle, will be tremendously valuable for you. You know, I took that advice pretty seriously. I still think I made my own decision, but it was very useful to have that sort of perspective and counsel. So that's what I did. And my calculation was that opportunity were of the two opportunities, that one was the one that was least likely to come my way again. That, you know, if I'd got a few good years of a career under my belt, particularly in a related discipline, that going back into an academic pathway should be even more possible. So that was my thinking at the time. But boy, oh boy, I've never had a week like that one.
The sliding doors, like you said, so many. Those two great opportunities, and just having to make, I mean, lovely. You've got both to choose from, major decision. So if we can jump forward, Michael, to more recent career decisions and changes for you, I'd sort of like you to give us your highlights and how you ended up in those different careers, whether they were things you decided or whether it was a bit of happenstance, perhaps.
I went to work for the federal police, which was kind of weird. Another of these sliding door moments. So I was working in an executive recruitment firm, my first period out in the private sector. And that firm decided to wrap up its executive recruitment business and focus on other areas of human resources work. And one of my colleagues said, oh, there's a, you know, there's this policy advisor job in the federal police. Would you be interested in putting your hat in the ring? And I said, oh, federal police? I know nothing about law enforcement. You know, maybe I'm even a little bit suspicious of some of the motives. But, you know, to her credit, she talked me into it. And, you know, so I ended up in this role working with a fabulous team of very experienced policy officers who'd come from a range of different backgrounds, many of whom were academically better qualified than I was. But it was just a tremendously dedicated, fun, intelligent bunch of people to work with. And at that stage, the federal police were on a rapid journey. So we're talking just after the Bali bombings. The AFP was on a rapid journey from being just a Commonwealth law enforcement agency to being a central national security agency. And in the time I worked there, we took the annual budget from about, from memory, about $250 million to $1.4 billion in only 3 years. And, you know, I had a lot of involvement in those budget strategies. But we had an executive and a commissioner at the time, Mick Kelty, who saw absolutely the importance of the AFP being able to play strategically and convincingly in the national security discussion and, you know, operate as an equal player with the Department of Defense and Immigration Department, the intelligence agencies around the table at the National Security Committee of Cabinet. And the AFP executive relied on my little group to really facilitate that. So I can't count how many cabinet submissions we wrote, but, you know, we were involved daily in high level whole of government meetings about these big national security issues. You know, post September 11 and the Bali bombings, as a real wake up call for Australia, particularly with the death toll that nation suffered in Bali, really was changing the mindset, and the Howard government was very much of the view that we needed to build much greater capability in that area and very, very quickly. So being involved in any organisation which is changing and growing at such a rapid pace, it's a white knuckle ride, but tremendously exciting. And you find yourself in the sort of role I was in, again, as you know, I wasn't even in the senior executive service at that stage. You can have tremendous influence, and with that comes great responsibility as well. So that was a tremendous highlight. And then off the back of work I did with the AFP on setting up the regional assistance mission to the Solomon Islands it was 2003, I got to know counterparts in AusAid, the former Australian Agency for International Development, Australia's the Australian Government Specialist Aid Agency. I got to know them very well, and eventually, because my prospects of a career path within the Federal Police at that stage as someone who wasn't a sworn officer was probably limited. It's not now. There are plenty of unsworn members of the AFP who are in the very senior ranks, but in those days it was less possible. So I transferred over to AusAid, initially running international and multilateral affairs, but very quickly was moved across to working on Southeast Asia. Again, you know, I hadn't studied Southeast Asia at university very much, partly because my father taught all the courses at ANU, and we just decided it would be better not to have that conflict. But I'm glad to say, much to my father's joy, ended up working on mainland Southeast Asia development policy and programming. Spent a lot of time in Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Burma, now Myanmar, and the Philippines and Timor-Leste in that early, my first big job in AusAid, and then ended up being posted with AusAid to Hanoi, again overseeing all of the Australian government's aid program in mainland Southeast Asia, and that was worth about $350 million a year. And that was just the most marvellous privilege. I travelled a lot, and I had at that stage quite young children with me in Hanoi and my wife. So it was a little hard on the family, but a tremendously stimulating role, and one where, again, I had a lot of capacity to influence outcomes and see and point to and show to decision makers how our programming was changing the lives of the poor and vulnerable in that part of the world, and how well recognized our contribution was as the Australian government there. And again, this coincided with the Rudd government's very strong commitment to increasing foreign aid. So we were suddenly managing a lot more resources. AusAid became a lot bigger very quickly, mirrored very much the experience at the AFP, and being part of managing that, again, a white knuckle ride where there was no textbook, there was no manual, and you had to take some chances, and you had to be confident and back your judgment, and you had to take decisions and move on because there was a lot to do. That was both a great opportunity, grounding, and helped develop my confidence, I suppose, in a basic level of good judgment, but also one of the principles I might come to a little bit later in our discussion around contestability of ideas and how you actually get the best of people and how you navigate very tough, complicated, sometimes contradictory landscapes and arrive at quality decisions about directions and ways forward. And, you know, I'd have to say, probably the last highlight I'd mark is where I am now.
Tell us a bit more about eWater and your role there and why you decided to take it up.
So I decided to leave the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, which had merged with AusAid in 2013. I decided to leave in 2009 for a few reasons. I felt that my capacity to further develop my skills and career in that department were more limited than they had been in AusAid. Partly that was because successive governments had decided to trim back the Australian aid budget. And with that, a lot of those of us who had been in AusAid prior to the merger left. Well, there wasn't the money for that sort of workforce to run a much smaller program. I decided to remain initially because I felt it was important to help train up the next generation of people who would be managing aid programs for the Australian government. But, you know, eventually I won't say I started to get bored, but I felt unchallenged and felt that I was doing international development 101 when You know, I had that experience of working for AusAid at the very top of its game. So, you know, maybe I was feeling the risk of being de-skilled. And one of the big international development management firms, which implements aid programming for DFAT and, you know, a range of other development agencies, including for the British and the US, a company called Palladium offered me a partnership job in the Asia Pacific practice. And I decided that was quite attractive and quite a good way to make a move from the public sector to the private sector and experience those dynamics of which are very different in the private sector. The fact that you need to make money, you need to do very clever and effective business development. You need to keep the idea stream going. It's a very competitive marketplace in international development, not only in Australia but elsewhere. I reasonably quickly came to the view that the culture fit wasn't right for me there. And then moved into management consulting for a while with a smallish Canberra firm that I'd known quite well. I'd been a client of theirs several times over the previous 20 years, and just had a wonderful time there. Really good, clever, committed, experienced colleagues, but also a very, very good, supportive culture. It restored my faith, I suppose, that the good work culture is important in high performing teams and highly effective organizations. And then somewhat unexpectedly, so eWater has two sides to its business. One is grounded in its history as a scientific research institution, started off life as a cooperative research center. But at the heart of eWater's original business and still at the heart of our business is hydrological modeling software. So software and advisory services around the modeling of how water behaves in Australian river systems and predicting the effects of both high flow and low flow scenarios and everything in between, how that might change as a result of climate change. Now, how Indigenous water knowledge and water rights play into decision making. So, essentially, that side of the business is about supporting decision makers to make good decisions around water resource management. The other side of the business is international development, the work that I knew pretty well from my time at AusAid and DFAT. So I came on board. Well, I got a call, incidentally, and mostly coincidentally, from Bob McMullen, who had been my first boss
How interesting.
after
Everything comes
the
full
Keating
circle.
government.
30
Bob,
years later.
30 years
More.
later, Bob was on the board of eWater and chaired the DFAT flagship program in water resource management called the Australian Water Partnership. And Bob called and said the CEO, who I knew a bit, Nick Schofield, a tremendous guy, he wants to retire and would you be interested? And I thought about it for probably 30 seconds and said, yeah, I would be very interested. It's back in the international development space, which I'd missed. I had to admit I'd missed the mostly the intellectual challenge of working in international development, because none of the answers are simple, because if they were, we'd have solved poverty 40 years ago. And back in that community which I knew, with a lot of colleagues who I had a lot of history with and had a lot of respect for. So I came to eWater as CEO of AWP, and there I thought I would be quite happily engaged for, at least the next 5 years. But then under 2 years later, the CEO of the other side of the business, which was then called eWater Solutions, again, a guy I had great respect for and worked tremendously well alongside, Dr. Robert Carr, retired, and the board decided to restructure the companies with a single CEO. And the chair of the board, who was then Don Blackmore, who had been CEO of the Murray-Darling Basin Commission for many years, a godfather in the Australian water management policy space. You know, he came and we had coffee and he said, we think we need to restructure the management. And I said, that's fine, just find a CEO I can work with. And he said, no, we'd like you to apply. And I said, I don't really think I'm qualified. You need someone from the Australian water policy community or the scientific community to run eWater. And I'm quite happy running AWP. And he said, well, I'd like you still to think about it and put in an expression. I said, well, that's very kind. Okay, I'll do that. And then long story short, the board appointed me. I was slightly daunted to begin with, but I came around to understanding Don and the board's logic. And that really is about water, wherever you're talking about water management and how water is allocated. It's a highly political question, particularly in a water scarce environment like Australia. And they appointed a political scientist, and now that makes sense.
I just got two more questions for you. If you reflect back on your career success, what do you think are the key things for you that's enabled you to have this marvelously diverse, successful career?
Yeah, so Felicity, I think one is not planning too doggedly, because I think if you have a definite career plan, I suppose I'm in. Part of me is envious of people who feel they have a calling and have a very confident line in terms of where they want to take their career. Maybe I was a little bit like that early on, but I found by not planning too doggedly, I've been open to doors springing open that I would never have expected, and more confident about walking through those doors than I might have been if I had a very set plan in my head, and mightn't actually have noticed the doors opening. Things that I can't imagine now not having done, but I never could have planned for, either because they happened by chance or because they were left field and unexpected. The second thing I think I've learned is not to sweat the small stuff and not to try and take career setbacks in your stride. So I have had some career setbacks. I've made some moves which haven't worked out, but you learn from those too. You learn more about what you need to be happy in a career. You learn more about what you need in order to be fulfilled and enjoy work. We spend an awful lot of time working in the average career, so you know, would be helpful if you enjoyed most of it. And it's made me very conscious of the red lines, things I won't put up with, things I might have put up with when I was younger, but I won't put up with now, in terms of, you know, behaviors, conflicting values, those sorts of things. And I think probably the last thing, and I alluded to it earlier in our chat, the value of nurturing an atmosphere of a contestability of ideas, so that everybody in your organization or team, no matter how long they've been there, no matter what level they are, feel empowered to put their viewpoints and ideas on the table and are rewarded for doing that, and are encouraged by, you know, particularly by their supervisors and bosses to do that. And the reason I think that's important is that maximizing the perspectives applied to a particular problem or set of problems or a particular challenge firewalls you against missing missing things. It's actually a really, really good risk management strategy, because you've got the best chance of having thought of all of the scenarios and all of the possible pitfalls before you arrive at a decision and a preferred way forward. And that really is, if I've got a management or leadership mantra, it's that one. And it's a mantra that I recite in my own interests, because I feel better defended. I feel trust and risk is better managed when we have that sort of atmosphere in the workplace. And it allows everybody to feel that they're contributing, and it gives people permission to be creative, to think outside the box, to innovate, to, you know, to test the odd crazy idea and take risks while being properly supported by management. Yeah, that would be the advice I'd give any sort of up and coming leader or incoming CEO.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Richard, anything from you?
Well, I've been listening to what Michael has been sharing, and I was thinking, I mean, we started with your values, and I feel that you have the career that you've shared so far, you've kind of lived everything that's been important to you. You've lived culture, you've lived politics, you've lived, you know, impact and influence, environment. So whether it's been planned or it's not been planned, I mean, subconsciously, it's kind of all flowed. And you have, you know, still many more years ahead of you. So it's been really, thank you so much for sharing this. I mean, it's been so fascinating just listening to you share with us about your journey and, you know, some of the challenges that you had to face, the white knuckle times. And yeah, I really appreciate your time today and all the information and nuggets that you've shared with us.
Yes, well, I just feel what I've experienced in my career has been a tremendous privilege. I just feel so lucky. I couldn't have predicted probably 85% of it. But, you know, I have had a fun career. I've really enjoyed it. I found it rewarding. I can point to legacies and positive change that I've been part of. And, you know, that's a pretty good feeling, really. And
that sounds like an amazing career.
And to really good people who were coming up behind, and, you know, hoping that I've modeled behaviors that are useful for them, and that I've helped talented people advance them their own careers.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for sharing all of that. And there's so much more I wanted to ask you, but unfortunately our time is up today. So thank you again, Michael, for your time and, yeah, sharing all of that. And I think that will inspire many of our career development practitioners when they're working with their various clients, making big decisions, maybe just don't overplan things too much.
Yep, that would be a bottom line. Yeah, thank you, Felicity, and thanks, Ruchira. It's been a privilege and a pleasure.
Thanks again. Bye.